Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's been said that sitting for long periods of time is just as bad as smoking. So manufacturers came up with the workplace standing desk, claiming they reduce the risk of obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and cancer. But when a team of researchers dug a little deeper, they couldn't find any substantial evidence to back up all the health benefits. Joining us now in the studio is one of the biggest cheerleaders for the standing desk and for standing in general, Dean of the College of Nursing and Chief Wellness Officer at Ohio State University, Dr. Bernadette Melnick. Welcome back as always.
Thanks, Anne.
When we were talking about this latest study, or I think it's actually a review of studies, I immediately, and they were saying the standing desk doesn't make any difference. I said, get Bern Melnick in here. And here you are. Thank you.
I am, and I'm ready to address this.
So they're these researchers are saying that all those standing and treadmill desks are basically useless when it comes to health benefits. What did you make of that review?
I think we have to remember systematic reviews of the evidence of multiple studies. That's the strongest level of evidence to guide our practice. I want to speak with caution to those studies' findings. Is it true that the evidence that we currently have is weak evidence? Yes, it is true. It is not true that decreasing sedentary time contributes greatly to improved health.
In other words, decreasing the time sitting on your butt.
Absolutely. Okay. What we need, though, Anne, is more rigorous randomized controlled trials with the use of standing desks in adults so that we can come and say 5 years from now, these are the outcomes. Most of the studies that have been done on standing desks use very small samples. They didn't have, many of them, the strongest designs. But I would not throw this whole body of evidence out at this point in time and say it doesn't work, because we have very high quality evidence to show people who sit more are predisposed to more cardiovascular disease, more diabetes, more obesity, more depression.
That's irrefutable.
Absolutely. These are huge population health studies that have been done to link increased sedentary time to a variety of chronic diseases, including cancer.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the debate over the standing desk and whether it works or not. There hasn't been enough evidence yet to show irrefutably that it helps, but there is irrefutable evidence that sitting too much isn't good for you. My guest is Dr. Bernadette Melnick. She is the Dean of the Ohio State's OSU School of Nursing and the Chief Wellness Officer at OSU. If you have a question or comment, if you use a standing desk, why don't you give us a call and tell us what you think about it? Just what's your personal opinion? Has it helped you, or do you think it hasn't made any difference at all? Give us a call, please. 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, people will say, well, here's the deal. Just get up more if you're sitting down. Now, I can't. I'm sitting here for pretty much 2 solid hours. I get up and take a break, and I ought to get up during the breaks maybe and walk around, but I forget because I'm sitting. My chair's there. What do we know about behavior when seated? Do we know anything about, have there been studies about that?
Yes, there have been some studies about reminders, people getting reminded by their Apple Watch. So I wear an Apple Watch, and every so many minutes I can program it to say stand. But in my case, I stand most of my days anyway. So there is good evidence that, again, just getting up, meeting the physical activity recommendation by the Centers for Disease Control, 30 minutes of physical activity every single day, or most days, at least 5 days a week, drastically drops your risk of chronic disease as we age.
And when you talk about the reminders, most people don't have reminders.
Correct.
Still.
Correct.
And without them, they're going to tend to just sit.
That's right. So that's where the social network and the workplace culture is really important. We at Ohio State, we have been working very hard on culture. We want to make healthy choices like getting up and moving on a regular basis, the easy choices for people to make. Peers, colleagues have major influence on that. We know people like to engage more in these kind of lifestyle activities when you do it in groups. So we have such things as wellness walks at the university on a regular basis. So this is built in. It becomes a habit. And sitting is more of the outlier kind of behavior.
Is there anything, so a lot of, Ohio State's a huge employer. It has the economies of scale in most places to allow that. But smaller companies, small businesses, they don't have the luxury of saying, everybody, let's get up and go for a wellness walk. Someone needs to stay back and get the phone or whatever. They just don't do it. So culture's a big part, but it's also, I guess, you know, you got to kind of crunch the numbers and tell employers what's the benefit to them.
Absolutely. You have to give people the evidence. I think culture eats strategy for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And whether you're a huge organization or whether you're a small business, it doesn't cost much money to get people moving or eating healthier. For instance, another program we have here at the university to help us change culture is a program called Faculty Staff Wellness Innovators. We have over 500 faculty and staff who currently work with me and my wellness team to create cultures of wellness in every nook and cranny across the university. Those people are key. They volunteer a few hours a month to engage their colleagues in healthy lifestyle behaviors.
Once again, we're waiting for people to call in and tell us how they like that standing desk. Maybe nobody's at a standing desk right now. You can email us if you can't call us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can check out our Facebook page and post a comment there if you want to share your experience with the standing desk. So somebody who is using a standing desk, they don't necessarily, shouldn't necessarily be standing all day or be on their feet all day.
It is what they prefer. Really. Okay. The key thing is to get up and down. Sitting is also, people don't realize this, Anne, but sitting is the biggest zapper of energy. The largest muscle we have in our bodies is what we sit on. And when you're sitting on it all day, blood is draining from your head down there to that big muscle.
But where's it draining when you're standing?
But you're moving.
Okay.
And that's the difference. Studies have shown you have more energy expenditure when you're standing more. We know that. Studies in school-age children, more research is coming up, not only on the benefits of the activity in school-age kids who stand, but their cognition, their memory, less behavior problems in the school setting. So more schools are moving to providing standing desks for students. In my College of Nursing, I provide that opportunity in my classrooms. And so many of my students prefer to stand through class versus sit. Their attention spans are better. They process better. But again, there's always more room for good, solid, rigorous studies to show the long-term benefits.
Jerome in Marysville, you're on the air. Hi, Jerome.
Hi. This is specifically or directly connected to wellness, but back in the 90s, there was all I was teaching in a university in Japan, and there was all sorts of proposals you'd see in the newspaper for standing desks to be used in meeting rooms in order to shorten the lengths of meetings. And having sat in endless number of faculty meetings, they last forever in Japan because everyone has to reach consensus.
Okay. I don't think it's just in Japan, Jerome, but that's a really interesting. But maybe
there was one professor who'd come in and just put her head down and go to sleep the whole meeting away.
Well, you know, Jerome, thanks for that light look at it. But on the other hand, it's possible that when you are standing, if you're more alert and refreshed and that kind of a thing, that you just get more work done in the meetings as well as anywhere.
Jerome, it's interesting you shared this because I tell all my colleagues at the university, in addition to the cardiovascular benefits of standing, you get through meetings a heck of a lot faster when you stand versus when you sit. So it's interesting you shared that tidbit with us.
Interesting. Thank you, Jerome, for that. Let's see. I'm going to take a call from Zach in Columbus now. Zach, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Fine. Thank you.
Hi. I was just calling to say that I use a sitting and standing desk.
So it goes back and forth if you want.
Well, actually, it's more like I have a section of it to be standing and a section of it to be sitting.
Okay.
And I fluctuate between the two because I actually get really uncomfortable sitting for prolonged periods of time, and it just, like, my legs physically hurt, and when I get up and walk around or use a standing desk, it's like a big relief for me.
Huh. And you noticed that it was noticeable?
Oh yeah.
Huh. All right, how long have you been using a standing desk?
Probably about a year now.
And what prompted you to start using one? Just the legs?
Yeah, I just sitting, like, I'm very uncomfortable, and I was worried about, like, blood flow in my legs, and I seem to be the only one with this problem, it seems like, in my office, because, like, everyone prefers to sit, and I like standing.
Okay. Thank you, Zach.
Oh, no problem.
Take care.
Thank you.
Yep.
So, Anne, it's a behavior change, too.
Yeah.
Think about it. If you've been used to sitting for years in your workplace, people get uncomfortable when you come in and say, let's have a standing meeting today instead of a sitting meeting. And we know behavior change is what I call character building. Most people don't change behavior unless crisis happens or their emotions are raised. Think about it. Every January 1st, people make a New Year's resolution to do something healthier. And research shows 90% of people who commit to a new healthy behavior fall off the wagon by the end of January.
It's a lot easier to get into the rec center parking lot right now. I'll vouch for that. That's for sure. Email from Casey says, how do I get my employers to shell out the money for one? It's $300 to $1,200 for one. Any suggestions, Bernadette?
Evidence. That's the best. And right now, again, I would show evidence related to sedentary time. Not, for instance, the use of standing desk. It's sedentary time.
Look at the evidence for the damages of sedentary sitting all the time. Okay.
Exactly.
All right. Casey, good luck with that. And then one comment from Ty in Columbus. You're on the air.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Great. Well, yeah, my question, or it's more just of a comment. I think it starts with company culture. And I worked for a large development company some years ago, and I'll never forget starting to work for this company. You know, every department depended on one another. but there was cubicles throughout the whole company, three floors of cubicles everywhere. But it was up to the individual to get up, to move around, to go meet with their counterparts, to interact.
Uh-huh.
But it still led to a kind of a just sitting on your bottom type of work environment. It really wasn't conducive to just getting up. And I think it starts a lot with companies, you know, looking into that, because you want to have a productive environment for individuals to get up, interact, and work and be more productive. So that's my comment. So I just wanted to kind of
That's interesting, though, because the very environment discourages you. Now we have emails, we have instant messaging, all that kind of junk, so we don't have to even get up and go talk to anybody. Bern is just nodding silently. Bern Melnick, you just received a $6.5 million grant ancillarily related to this. Can you tell us about it real quick?
We're just up out of time. Yeah. So this was given to us, our College of Nursing, by the Helene Fold Health Trust Foundation out of New York City to establish a national institute for evidence-based practice. So we will be the hub or the clearinghouse of a variety of best practices based on the best evidence regarding a variety of healthcare and health topics. So stay tuned for more information about that.
Bernadette Melnick, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, Sam.
Bernadette Melnick, she's the Dean of the Ohio State School of Nursing and the Chief Wellness Officer at OSU. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has issued new guidelines for medical professionals to discourage them from overprescribing opioids to treat chronic pain. The move by the federal government is aimed at stopping a deadly drug epidemic responsible for nearly 50,000 deaths in the U.S. 40% of those are due to prescription opiates. Ohio has been following similar guidelines since the start of the year, but in a report released yesterday by the CDC, deaths from fentanyl, an opiate that is 30 to 50 times more potent than heroin, have skyrocketed in the Buckeye State. Joining us now in the studio is Executive Director of the Delaware Morrow Mental Health Recovery Services Board, Steve Hedge. Welcome.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Also from the Ohio State Medical Association, Senior Director of Government Relations, Tib Maglione. Welcome.
Thank you.
So the new federal guidelines, can you give us a thumbnail of what they are and how they expect to curb the problem?
Sure. Tim? I'll take that first. First of all, I guess to take a step back and see how we got to where we are today.
Yeah.
You know, there was a period of time when pain was considered to be undertreated, and more aggressive efforts were instituted to try to treat pain, particularly with medications. And that happened in the late 80s and early 90s. And now you kind of fast forward, and these drugs, of course, can have dangerous effects if they're misused or abused.
Well, they're highly addictive for one thing.
Absolutely. And so that's why there are now reconsiderations of the prescribing guidelines for these types of medications. And this new CDC effort has these guidelines. So essentially, in a nutshell, what it's saying is that the medication should not be the first resort in terms of the treatment option for the patient. Are there other things that you can do with the patient to relieve the pain? If you do need to go with an opiate, a prescription drug, start low and go slow is essentially what the CDC is saying. So it is a new protocol for how doctors and other prescribers will think about writing these medications.
But it's not a requirement. In other words, if you want, and if you know you're dealing with maybe a low-income person who doesn't have a lot of access to, you know, whatever the equation might be, it's going to be harder for them. You know they need it.
Yeah.
You can still prescribe it.
So guidelines are establishing, in a way, a standard of care. But there's not a one-size-fits-all practice of medicine. Every patient is unique, and I think the guidelines will provide some parameters, and you can go outside of those if it's clinically justified.
Steve Hedge, why are people overdosing?
Well, maybe to build on what Tim was just saying, we also think it's valuable not only for the healthcare professionals to look at the guidelines and look at alternative ways, but also they educate the patient, the person that's receiving those, because it's a two-way street of actually being educated of the effects of these. And as Tim mentioned, they can be very addictive and so forth. So we're encouraging folks not only to be educated about their illness, but also some of the medications.
And part of that comes from educating doctors who prescribe as well, because back in the 80s, when a lot of these opioids became very popular, they were relying on faulty research that suggested that the drugs weren't as addictive as they are.
That's right. And so we've learned a lot from that. And these new guidelines kind of take into consideration the danger of these are if they're misused and abused. And so the education of prescribers is very important. And at the Ohio State Medical Association, we've developed a program called SmartRx, which is an online interactive educational tool for doctors to know what the new rules are in terms of emergency departments and how they get prescribed there, in terms of patients that are on high doses of these particular medications, and for acute care settings. So there's a lot of new rules, and we've got a program to really educate the prescribers and doctors about those.
And yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, the other end of it, as was mentioned, that some folks do need these medications for legitimate reason, but also they can be overused and abused. And that's what we see in the treatment side, particularly in our two-county area, Delaware and Morrill counties, is that the people that are presenting now for addiction treatment tend to have started on prescription pain pills and gone to heroin because of the overuse and the need to actually deal with their addictions. That, I mean, a lot of them did start for legitimate reasons. They had a pain, they had an injury, a surgery that they started on pain pills, but over a long period of time, they were no longer needed, but the body was
according
contended.
To the doctor.
Absolutely. They were no longer prescribed the medications, but they went to an alternative, which actually is a less expensive illicit drug, heroin, which is very prevalent in the Central Ohio area.
Once they became aware of the addictive properties of these opioids, why is it? I've heard this story a lot we've all heard it a lot, that people start legally, they're being treated for a real pain. Mm-hmm. The pain goes away, but the addiction stays with them. Are physicians just not getting that? Are they not? Is there a protocol that they could go through to figure out whether or not their patient has also become addicted?
Well, that
before
again,
they just take them off it,
right? There is a lot of that education that's going to be a part of these CDC rules and assessing the patient and those types of questions. So, I guess the good news is, at least at this point in time, and Ohio's been well ahead of the curve on these new protocols for prescribing. The CDC just came out this week with their guidelines. Mm-hmm. We've had guidelines now in Ohio for the last couple of years, and we've started to see a real change in prescribing patterns. The number of prescriptions is down about 11% from 2015 to 2014. The doses are down. The strength of the prescriptions are down. And the use – we have this really unique program in Ohio called ORS. It's a prescription drug monitoring database. And doctors can go to that and they can get the prescription history of all of their patients and know whether or not they've seen three other doctors for the same condition and gone to three other pharmacies to try to get – so these doctor shoppers and people that are illegally trying to get these things, we're able to identify them. And we've shut that down in a significant way. So now – you know, again, what's happened is the prescription drugs are now harder to get. And actually, heroin on the street, the street drugs, is more available.
It's easy to attack, right.
And so we now need to focus our attention. The prescribing of medications, I think we're on the right track. Mm-hmm. What we need to focus on now is addiction treatment and opportunities for recovery. But there are roadblocks to that. Mm-hmm. A lot of insurance companies in their health plans, they don't cover a comprehensive addiction treatment or medication-assisted treatment. And I strongly believe that needs to be the next emphasis in a significant way.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Steve Hedge, talk about that. I mean, a lot of people, when they wind up where you're sitting as executive director of the Delaware Morrow Mental Health Recovery Services Board, by then they don't have the resources to get treatment. And even if they did, there aren't the facilities out there.
Right. Well, again, stepping back, that we know that addiction does not discriminate.
Right.
It is an illness and a disease that no matter if you're male, female, economic class, race, people are addicted in all those categories. So we don't see a particular class of folks that can be addicted or not addicted. So that's the way we approach it, that we have a system that we have in place that will deal with anyone that comes into our doors. Obviously, as you mentioned, we don't have always the capacity, particularly for some of the specialized services, particularly detoxification,
right?
Because of limitation of capacity. But a number of other programs we just put in place that are supposed to support people in that condition.
Rob in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Rob.
Good morning. And my question is in relation to the studies claiming that opioid pain prescriptions weren't dangerous. In other cases, medical cases, there's been influence either from the business community, say pharmaceuticals, or a legal person that's looking to make money.
Sure.
Off the results of that has.
Well,
it blows my mind that you know that those cases would have said that the opioid pain pills were not dangerous to prescribe. I just didn't know if there was influence there.
Well, it's interesting. I learned about it from reading the book Wonderland, which talks about the heroin epidemic as it emerged from Portsmouth, Ohio, in the United States. And it was just one study, not a good study, that was sort of blown out of proportion, that didn't say that the drugs were dangerous, but said that they weren't addictive. And that's kind of the key issue here, is the addiction issue. And now that's been rectified in recent years.
So in relation to that, again, I think back in the 80s and early 90s, there was a concern that we were under-treating pain. And so there were aggressive efforts to deal with that. And the FDA has a process for approving drugs and determining whether they're safe and effective. They did that for a number of these drugs. Ultimately, though, what was found later is that one of the major pharmaceutical companies was found to have misled the FDA and was fined almost $600 million for that. But all that time, you had physicians who were relying on what was credible FDA-approved literature about the effectiveness of these things. And so, again, I think it's one of those things where the pendulum has swung too far, and it's coming back to the middle now on the prescribing, but we've got to deal now with the heroin epidemic.
Are there forces at work among the pharmaceuticals against this, or are they?
No. Actually, I think, you know, some of them now are trying to develop alternative pain medications without the opiate kind of effects. And certainly those that need that, they're trying to develop them that are abuse deterrent so that you can't crush them, melt them, and do things to increase the strength.
Steve Hedge, why do people overdose? They're not trying to kill themselves when you overdose. So there's a distinction there. Why does that happen?
Correct.
Typically.
Again, I think, again, with any medication that there's, your body builds up tolerance.
Okay.
So you need to continue to increase the amount that you take to get the same level of either high or discomfort level. Because, again, the folks that we deal with don't come into our treatment saying, I want to be an addict. They actually, to maintain their life, have a job, have a family, saying, I really want to get off these drugs because they're just basically ruining my life. And my whole life is surrounding these drugs of choice. That basically what is happening is that people are using illicit drugs that they're not FDA approved. They don't have the quality that you would see in a medication. So you don't even basically know what's being shot in your arm.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's happened. A lot of the overdose deaths, it's a combination of something that may not even be approved by anyone to be putting into some of those heroin. Fentanyl is a good example that some people are using synthetic fentanyl to include with heroin.
Uh-huh.
And again, not knowing the quantity and the purity of it, you just don't know what you're shooting. So that's a lot of the overdoses are related to that. But again, we don't see anyone saying, I want to kill myself just based
right.
on taking heroin. Another issue, I think, that some of the good news, there is a lot more research going in the effect on medications on the brain. And we applaud the effort to really see what the effects are. And we know that a long-term heroin addict, their brain chemistry has changed. So that's why you have to approach it from that perspective, medical community. The other good news is there are new medications, what we call medication-assisted therapy, in which that either blocks or reduces the effect of taking an opioid like heroin, so you can actually maintain a life. And with a long-term acting, you basically, with a new medication that's called naltrexone or Vivitrol is the name brand of it, basically a person can function. It's an injection that lasts 30 days. So you can see there's efforts medically and research-wise of getting to the point that people can function in their normal
and
lives.
And that doesn't replace heroin like a methadone. I mean, it blocks it, but you still, if you're taking it or if you're going through withdrawal from an opioid, it still, it lets you go through the withdrawal without that feeling of feeling badly, but it doesn't get you, for lack of a better word, high.
Absolutely. That's the whole impact of having these medications, the new medication. Basically, it blocks in the nerve cell. So if you were to take an opioid when you're on these medications, it has no effect on the body. But also, as you said, it blocks the craving and the withdrawal, which is a horrendous impact on the body, withdrawing from these medications because they are so addictive and it changes your mentality in your brain. So the other thing that we stress is not only taking medication to deal with your addiction, but also the counseling part of it, because the psychological impact and the other parts of your life have been dramatically altered by this habits and dealing with drugs such as heroin.
Tim Maglione, what about the issue of funding for recovery from addiction? You said a lot of insurance companies don't cover it.
Yeah, that's one of the hurdles. And so, you know, I think the legislature here in Ohio and around the country, state legislatures in the Congress need to have that discussion. What are the hurdles to getting access to some of these recovery options, recovery housing, medication-assisted therapy, counseling, through insurance restrictions? And if there are those, and we believe there are, we need to address those by creating new laws that provide this access.
Okay. Well, let me take one call. Linda in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Linda.
Hi. How you doing?
Fine. Thank you.
Good. Hey, I recently spent about a day and a half in the hospital for a kidney stone. And when I was discharged, I hadn't passed the stone yet, and they were prescribed a painkiller. And when the doctor came in to give me the prescription, he basically said, "So what do you want?" And my husband happened to be there, and the two of us were kind of in shock because he was offering me opioids, saying that I was going to be in a lot of pain when the kidney stone passed, and he was willing to write me a prescription for anything I wanted. You know, I know a little bit about this issue, and so I was shocked and stunned that someone it was not an ER doctor, but somebody in what they call the observation area would just say, "So what do you want?"
Well, it goes to the issue that of how difficult it is to treat pain.
Yeah, it does, and I think that particular scenario obviously that shouldn't happen, and I think again. Prescriber education and things that we're trying to do to make sure that the opiate is not the first line of defense on treating pain.
Don't a lot of doctors, though, resist alternative measures?
You can think about, physical therapy, for
there's
example.
Physical therapy,
is
but there's
chiropractic,
also
acupuncture, things like that. Sure. No, I think there's been more acceptance of those types of things as an alternative to treating pain than the medications. And so I think that's evolved too over time. What I'm hoping, though, again, is a combination of things that are going to happen going forward. More prescriber education, which we're committed to doing, but expanding access to treatment and substance abuse recovery. You know, as Steve said, addiction is not a choice. It's not a flaw in character. It is a disease, and for those that have become addicted, we need to provide help, and so we're on the path to doing that too. I think just the U.S. Senate under Senator Rob Portman passed a bill last week that will provide additional funding to states for some of these type of addiction recovery programs. So more needs to be done, but to me that's the next step in addressing this issue.
Tim Maglione, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time. That's Tim Maglione. He's Senior Director of Government Relations at Ohio State Medical Association. And Steve Hedge, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Steve Hedge, he's Executive Director of the Delaware Morrow Mental Health Recovery Services Board. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. March Madness. This time of year, it's all about college basketball. But no matter the sporting season, the intensity of watching a high-stakes game for some is too stressful, wrought with epic highs. And bitter lows.
Why are you crying?
I don't know. I got the Patriots.
Well, why are you sad?
Because the Patriots lost.
And then what?
They don't get to go to the Super Bowl today.
As a Spartan fan, I know the feeling all too well this year. We're talking about how to manage the stress of sports appreciation. Joining us by phone is sports psychologist and professor of clinical psychology at Western Kentucky University, Dr. Rick Grieve. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. Thank you. I must say I do share your having grown up in what I think is called the state up north. Friday was not a good day for this sports fan.
It was not a good day. And you know, I was just really, really sad like that kid. You know? I wasn't sobbing, but some people get super stressed out. A study in 2011 found a link between heart attacks and fans with a team that lost the Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. What are the physiological links of, is it just the watching of sports or knowing that your team lost?
You know, I think it's a little bit of both. All of the research that I've seen that has been done, when we look at physiological reactions to sports, it all depends on how much you care or whether you care. You know, if I kind of follow a team and they lose, well, that's okay. But if I'm a diehard fan, I'm going to have some pretty significant reactions. And part of that can be, as the research shows there, coronary events, which doesn't happen often, but it does. There does seem to be a slight link there.
So, you know, there's that overexertion kind of a thing, that stress where you're screaming at the television set. We, mm-hmm. you know, we hear about that. Is that what's causing, I mean, are you actually exerting yourself in a way that creates the event?
I am not sure if you can put a single link to it. Uh-huh. I would think that because I wouldn't want people to think that it's going to be, here's a healthy person sitting there and something bad happens and, you know, I'm coming to see you, Ethel.
Yeah, the NFL and the NBA and the NHL wouldn't appreciate it.
No. So I would think that you know, you would see the cardiac events in terms of, or with people who were already at risk for that. People who already have heart disease and other problems related to the cardiovascular system. And then, you know, when you do put stress on that system, the bad things can happen. But the stress can come from a number of different places. Sporting events would be only one of them.
Why do people feel such strong connections between themselves and whatever they perceive as their team?
Right. You know,
because a lot of people are big Buckeye fans who maybe not even stepped foot on campus.
Yes. And that's a wonderfully interesting phenomenon. How many people are extremely strong supporters of a college team who haven't even been there. Mm-hmm. I'm currently, as you mentioned, in Kentucky, and there are a lot of humongous University of Kentucky fans who couldn't tell you one thing about campus. because I think there are a couple of reasons why people do become attached to teams. Number one, it does serve as a self-reflection on the person. So if I select a team and the team does well, that then reflects back on me and the choices that I've made, and I can do what we call basking in reflected glory. That is, Ohio State wins a national championship. I'm an Ohio State fan. Therefore, I receive some of those accolades that the team achieved, and it reflects well on me. And this boosts my self-esteem, and it helps me, well, feel good about myself. In addition, being a sport fan also brings about connections with other people. If I'm an Ohio State fan and I'm away in another city, say I'm off visiting California, Los Angeles, New York, somewhere there, walking down the street and I see somebody else with Buckeye gear on, I have an instant connection with that person. I've got a colleague, a friend, and those connections there can help with some of the psychosocial health, or they come with psychosocial health benefits. We found that folks who have stronger connections with local teams tend to feel less lonely, especially when they're at the sporting events, tend to have less stress when they're at sporting events. So even though the more important events can bring about some physiological reactions, when you ask people about the psychological impact, there does seem to be some psychological benefit to being a sport fan.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking to Dr. Rick Grieve. He's a psychologist at Western Kentucky University, and we're talking about our tendency to, or for some people, to overemphasize the success of their favorite sports teams to the point, maybe sometimes, to their own detriment. A study in 2011 found a link between heart attacks and fans with a team that lost the Super Bowl, for example. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. I kind of chuckle, and I shouldn't. That's bad. I don't mean to laugh about that. But why do some people get more connected than others? Like, I'm a big Spartans fan, right. But I am not going to blow a gasket, although I almost did get kicked out of a bar one time. But that's after we won when everyone
right. It. You know, I think there are a number of different avenues towards that that people take to get that connection. One thing that I firmly believe is that we all have this need to belong. And being a sport fan is a real easy way to show that I belong. Like I talked about that social connection. Mm-hmm. I'm here close to Nashville, Tennessee, and I'm a big Nashville Predators fan. And when I walk around wearing my Nashville Predators hat, I see several fans, even up here in Bowling Green, which is an hour away from Nashville. I see several other people who instantly become my best friends because mm-hmm. they obviously have good taste and good judgment. But I have that connection, and that social belongingness, I think, is really important. We used to get it here by joining groups like, you know, Elks, Knights of Columbus, Rotary Club, those kinds of social groups. But those types of involvements have decreased over the years. But at the same time, you've actually seen an increase in the number of people who have been sport or who claim to be sports fans.
Where do you know, or when do you know that perhaps you've reached a tipping point where your love of this team is maybe unhealthy for you? It's not giving you the good kind of satisfaction and the good kind of belonging that, you know, the good things that you get from having a team.
That is an excellent question. I would say that when you start seeing your fandom interfere with your occupation, all right, so being a fan is my reactions to the games interfere with my ability to do my work the next day, or interpersonal interaction. So it's messing up or it is impacting my relationship with my significant other or my children or my peers. When you start seeing those effects, and that can signify that you are having a maladaptive relationship with the team.
I sort of tested my resilience by immediately reaching out on Facebook to my Syracuse friends, telling them, you know, I didn't even say it's a gift or anything. I just said, hey, go Syracuse. You know what?
Right.
I tried to ameliorate it that way.
Absolutely.
Is that a good idea?
I think so. I think it helps, that is a very adaptive reaction to a loss. I think when a team loses and loses in a big game, there are several reactions. Yes, I know. There are several reactions. I think the best reaction is simply to reinterpret what happened. You know, take a look and say the Spartans really did have a good year this year,
yeah.
and they got caught in a game with a couple of players that got hot in that game. And so take a look and say this was a really good year, rather than defining the entire year by the outcome of a single game.
I feel like I'm in a little bit of a therapy session. Right now.
Well, I went on a long trip. I was actually traveling across the state on Friday and did a lot of my own therapy on the way there. So you're only hearing the things that I told myself.
You know, there's a famous study at Georgia State University in 1998 that showed that male spectators of sporting events experience the same testosterone surges as the players themselves.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, I did read that study, and it looks like it's that connection that we have with the team, and there are a couple of different hypotheses, and I'm probably going to get them wrong here. One talking about competitive types of arenas, and with men, anytime there's a competition, we do see, especially if we're associated with that team, we do see those rises in testosterone.
Well, could that be sort of a way of getting addicted to sports?
I am not a physiologist. But I think that it's not necessarily the testosterone increase that's going to increase addictive potential.
Okay.
I think actually you're going to look at some other neurochemicals. Serotonin would be the one that I would lay it at the doorstep. And I'm not sure we've looked at that. I know that there was the 98 study that showed that testosterone increased. And then we didn't do anything until about 2008. So there's not been a whole lot of research in the area. And the interesting study in 2008 is they actually looked at, the researchers looked at testosterone levels of people who were following the election, the presidential election, and found similar results. If you were a male Obama supporter, testosterone levels increased when you found out that he had won the election.
Wow! Talk about basking in reflected glory.
Exactly. if it was McCain, then right. If you were a McCain follower, they dropped. Testosterone levels dropped.
That's really interesting.
But here's the real interesting part is
just about out of time. Yeah.
Yeah. It only works for men, not for women.
Have they tested that?
They did. They looked at both men and women. There was no change in women.
So. All righty. Well, Dr. Rick Grieve, thanks for joining us today. It was a lot of fun.
You're welcome.
I
My
feel
pleasure.
Better. You bet. Dr. Rick Grieve, professor of clinical psychology at Western Kentucky University. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.